in this Halloween season, we get on the telephone line and welcome in our friend Colin Fleming to talk about classical horror music. Hello, Colin.
What's up, Hard Rocking? What should I call you today? Hard Conducting. And man espousing Socratic wisdom. I like that.
How are you and the monument getting along these days?
Oh, I only did one climb today, but I did 5 yesterday and 5 the day before. And then I like to get a hot chocolate and come on and mull various components of my life as I wait to talk on your show. And today I was thinking, I am a man who eats too many Triscuits. And
really?
I need to work on that. Also, I think I would be better served if I started calling more people baby girl. That's what I've come up with today. Woven wheat, baby girl. I think next time when you speak to me in a week from now, I think I'll probably be on the path to happiness.
There's no doubt about it, baby boy. Now, are we talking plain Triscuits, or do you venture into those flavored types?
There isn't a lot that I wouldn't be into in the terms of the woven wheat. I like it. I like the construction, the engineering of it. I like how it's nicely aerated. And because I deprive myself of sodium because of my concerns about my heart, and hence the monument, it's the only intake of salt that I get for the most part. So I am like a guinea pig tonguing the woven wheat to get the salt before I consume that good fiber. And frankly, my diet is pretty much just coffee and melatonin so I can go to sleep. And I am addicted to the woven wheat.
See, I like the Triscuit because it's a substantial cracker. It holds up to, I'm a hummus guy myself. I love the hummus. It'll hold up to your hummus, your dip, you name it. But when you eat a Triscuit, you know, it's not like a chip. It's not like a wheat thin. You've consumed something when you've taken down a Triscuit.
No, it's like the pumice of snack crackers, really. It doesn't weigh as much as a Ritz cracker, but you can build off of it. It's granitic and yet aerodynamic, and I am just all about that Triscuit. I'm into it. So thank you, Nabisco.
Yes. The Ritz, for me, highly overrated. It's good with, you know what, peanut butter. Stop. End of story. But the Triscuit is a versatile cracker. It goes with anything, and there's a beautiful complexity to it.
Look, dude, I stayed back in nursery school. Sorry, Mom, I'm going to say this. I stayed back because you were supposed to make these sandwiches out of peanut butter and Ritz crackers. And I struggled with this, and they would turn to dust in my hand, and I would hurl what remained violently across the room. And the teacher's like, you know, Mrs. Fleming, this guy, he might not be quite ready socially to move on to the next level. I'm like, let's do this, you mofos. Right the next year, there I was again. I'm thinking like, all my class, all my little friends are gone.
All for want of a Triscuit.
Yep, there
if
it goes.
Only we had known. But that's not why we're here, although clearly we need to do an entire segment sometime on snack crackers. But let's talk today about classical horror music. We heard a bit of the Transylvanian dances coming in. What makes good classical horror music?
It didn't necessarily, in the minds of these composers, start out as things that would be friendly for our presumptions with the macabre. And for instance, Béla Bartók there, you are getting these almost rustic dances. They happen to come from Transylvania, but we have to remember that not everything Transylvanian was vampiric. It wasn't Bela Lugosi lurking around or his forerunner around every catacomb corner. And you have these autumnal, very folksy dances that he interpolated into the canon, essentially. And this is crucial because you didn't really get this. It wouldn't seem like you could have a kind of modernistic music via a folk music. In this country, we got that with Charles Ives. He would do that. But classical music was very buttoned up, and it was radical of Bartók bringing in these Transylvanian strains. Now, if you were a vampire in that land of lore, yeah, you'd know lots of these tunes. They were like the hits of your day. They were playing on your version of the radio, which was the inn that you went by on your way into the town at night to suck the neck of some fair maiden. And they do have that sense of place about them, because I don't think you can really parse out that melange, that sort of prevailing creepiness, at least to our ears right here in the States, that you get with anything out of Transylvania.
All right, let's move on to Mozart and Descend into Hell with Don Giovanni. Do we have some of this?
Awesome.
We have a little, I believe. Going to hell in a handbasket right there.
Yes, and this is funny because this is, I would say, probably the greatest opera ever written and arguably the greatest work that Mozart ever did. Now, if more people knew about this, more people actually knew about things beyond what is trending on Twitter right now and won't be 45 minutes from now, they would be racing to end this from ever being performed or sold in stores or downloadable or anything. So what's happening here in this particular scene is Don Giovanni is a rake. He is not the greatest of dudes. And he is in the cemetery because that's where he hangs out a lot of times. And he's fled from some people that want to kill him and everything. And he meets up with his servant there. And his servant's like, "Oh, I'm so happy to see you, sir." And Don Giovanni is like, "That's funny, dude. I was just dressing up as you so I could try and hook up with your girlfriend." And the guy's like, "What?" And they're standing in front of the statue, and the statue has some placard at the bottom that says, like, "I was murdered. I'll get revenge upon thee." And so Don Giovanni says to his servant, he said, "You know what? Why don't you invite the statue to dinner with us? It'll be fun." The guy's like, "No, I'm not doing that." So finally Don Giovanni says, "Okay, I'll do it." He asks the statue to go out to eat with him. Statue's like, "Sure, I'll come to life. I'll do that." Statue shows up later. It does not go well. It's like you and I always say to each other. Pork is not just a meat, it's a verb. No, only kidding, faithful listeners. Don't worry about that. But the statue, he comes to life, and he takes Don Giovanni straight into the depths of hell. And so Mozart wanted to replicate, via his imagination, what that would sound like. And it is indeed how I think probably that descent into the kingdom of Dante would go.
All right, let's listen to a little more. What do we have here? Carrie, let's see what we've got. One of the best known pieces. For some reason, I don't know why, that scared the heck out of me when I would listen to that as a little kid of about 4 or 5.
Yeah, it's very odd because it's like it occupies this strange space between keys. And we have this sense with our ear, with classical music, that we're going to hear something polished, right? Now, that's almost like a plain song version of a scary text set to music and bordering on the atonal. And that's just, it's disorienting. And that, I think, is what a lot of these pieces have in common. Like with the Mozart, we notice that it's not really in this, it's the key of stabbing, almost.
Mm.
Right? It's this staccato, violin, cyclonic burst. We'll get that same cyclonic element, that cyclonic sway with something like Danse Macabre by Cézanne. You know, everybody knows that one, right? It comes from, I think I heard it in a Reese's Pieces commercial recently. But it's that swaying quality that takes us out of a comfort zone of what's the ear. The ear, it's like our thoughts. The ear has expectations. You might not know a piece of music, but if you're listening to it and you hear there's a number of notes in succession, your ear wants to hear kind of the resolving note of that progression. And what works like these ones that we're listening to right now do is they deprive you of that expectation. They take you out of that space where everything is smooth, it's tonal, and it becomes this grab bag of what comes next. I'm not quite ready for this.
You shared a piece or information on a piece by Schubert. I'm not familiar with this one. Can you tell me more about it?
Oh, sure. It's we're talking about the Erl King. And the Erl King is the king of the elves. And this is a piece for one voice with four characters. Now, there's a narrator, there is a father, there's a son, and there is the king of the elves, who is not a guy you want to be long in the company of. And it's based upon a poem by Goethe, and it is harrowing. It's the piano and just the voice. So the voice has to work within these four different colorations. It has to have depth to it, so you get separation between the characters. And it's a very demanding piece to play. What is happening in it is a father, and we don't know his background. We don't know what class he's in. He's riding out frantically with his son. And that's all we know about his station in life. We don't know if he's relatively poor. We don't know if he's some lord, whatever it may be. And this child, the son, is not well. He's sick. And he is, as we learn, as this poem goes along, he's delirious. And he thinks he is being stalked by the king of the elves, who is trying to rip him to the underworld. And it's a very demanding piece to sing, but it's also a very demanding piece to play, because it comes at you in this fusillade of triplets on the piano. In fact, the only time it lets up, where you get a little break, where Schubert wrote in this break so you can make it through it as the pianist, is when the Erl King sings his part. But even the horse with the galloping, with those triplets, even the horse sounds like it's terrified. Guy shows up at where he's trying to get to, it's kind of like a hospital, and the kid's dead. And it's a little turn of the screwish, because you don't know if this kid just went out of his mind or whatever inner demons he was plagued by, or he was snatched by the Erl King, the Elf King.
All right, we're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown about classical horror music. Now let's summon the vampires here. Well, I can almost see Vlad the Impaler coming forward right now.
Sure, and in this case, the text is based upon, so right now we have Marschner's The Vampire. Marschner was a guy who was pretty successful in the early portion of his career, who would be overshadowed by Wagner at the end of it. And so this is the early, this is the 1820s. So we don't have what we think of as Dracula until 1897 with Stoker's novel. But this was around for a while. And the opera is actually based upon The Vampire by John Polidori. And John Polidori, actually 200 years ago, he was Lord Byron's physician. And he was one of the ones hanging out with Shelley and Mary Shelley, and they're having their ghost story writing competition. Big falling out between Byron and his doctor. I love that he had a personal doctor. You know you are up to some no good when you have to take around your BD doctor with you. And Polidori wrote this fragment that invented a lot of what we now know as the modern vampire, that he was urbane, that he was smooth with the ladies, all of the tropes that Stoker later himself used. And so Marschner based this opera, this two-act opera, on Polidori's mostly forgotten, though it doesn't deserve to be, short story, novella, maybe, if we're being generous in terms of its length. And right away from the beginning, you have this, again, atmospheric, and instead of Dracula, we have Lord Ruthven. And he is at a witch's Sabbath. Many of these works operate around the premise of the witch's Sabbath, which is like a party once a year for the witches, and they wait upon Satan to show up. They're like, ooh, it's Waiting for Godot, but with the devil. And the devil says to Lord Ruthven, he said, look, if you kill three virgins, I will, I'll give you another year of life. Otherwise, you don't get the year. It's only a year. I mean, it's not like 500 years. I mean, whether you live to be 87 or 86, does it really matter? So that is what he sets out to do, and that is what the plot is about.
And finally, a little something from Grieg, a portion of Peer Gynt that will qualify as classical horror music.
Yes, and this, a lot of these pieces, what they have in common is, in addition to those stabbing rushes of notes, they have these mega riffs. Now, they wouldn't have called them riffs. They would have called them ostinatos, which is a fancy word for riff. But if you've heard Smoke on the Water, or you've heard this particular In the Hall of the Mountain King from this suite, it is all about that riff. Dun 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 dun. It becomes huge. It swells. It has the same volume swelling chords you get from the Jeff Beck era Yardbirds, but with these cymbal crashes. If you are a cymbal player, this is a fun one to absolutely go to town on, as it builds and builds and builds, and it's just these waves, these breaking waves of violent swash up on this terror beach, and it's thrilling, because at the same time, you want to get up and have yourself a good old pagan jig to this bad boy.
Well, there you go. A little something to listen to for your fall season and Halloween pleasure, or any time of year for that matter. Some great classical horror music with our friend Colin Fleming. Thank you, Colin. Have a good week.
Woven weeds, baby girl.
We will talk with you next Tuesday. Colin Fleming on Downtown.